How many of you own car insurance? How often do you think about your insurance company? Are you happy with your insurance company? Do you delight in your insurance company? Most of us never think about car insurance unless they send us a bill at home, and then we gripe about the size of the bill. We know it's a necessity. We know it's a law, and so we pay it grudgingly. But imagine today that as you drive home from church, you have an accident. And you're not hurt, the driver of the other car is not hurt, but his car is totaled. And it's your fault. And furthermore, this is a late model BMW, and it's worth at least $25,000. And you've just wrecked it. Suddenly, your relationship with your car insurance company changes, doesn't it? You're now very, very thankful for this car insurance company that has kind of come and do the assessment and pay the bill minus whatever your deductible is. You're very thankful to have a company which is reliable and professional and will take care of the mess that you have made. Before the accident, your car insurance company was a mandated necessity. After the accident, you highly appreciate the company. Well, something similar happens in Exodus between chapters 28 and 34. In chapters 28 and 29, you may recall, we looked at the role of a mediator in the description of the clothing that the priests are assigned by God and in the description of the ordination of the priests. God gives us a picture of who Jesus is, and he gives us a picture of our mediatorial role for those who do not yet trust in Jesus. Well, in the sermons on those chapters, I defined the role of the priests as those chosen and set apart by God for a purpose to mediate between God and those separated from him through displaying and proclaiming God's character, through intercession, and through announcing the provision of a sacrifice or providing a sacrifice on their behalf. Three roles for a priest. Priests are mediators between God and man. But remember where those chapters 28 and 29 come in the overall storyline of the book of Exodus. As we emphasize in the sermons on the Ten Commandments, back in chapter 20, God had said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." He says, "I am your God right now. I am your God." The people are already in relationship to God. And the people have responded to him both in chapter 19 and then twice in chapter 24. "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Now, this leads to a logical question. If the people are already his, he is their God, and they've committed themselves to following him in obedience, why is there a need for a mediator? So we have these chapters on the role of a mediator, and yet it's not so obvious that there's a need for mediation. Now, there are some hints along the way why a mediator is important. Just like prior to the accident, you would have some idea about why the insurance company was important. First, you may remember way back when the people were in Egypt, in chapter 5, Moses has shown up and said God has told him that he's going to lead them out of the land of Egypt, and the people are all excited. And then he goes to Pharaoh, and what does Pharaoh do? He makes their work a lot harder, right? He says, now, no more straw, you got to collect straw, and you got to make just as many bricks as before. And remember the reaction of the people? They get really mad at Moses. He said, you haven't saved us at all. You're just making things worse and worse. So that's an indication that maybe these people don't have complete confidence in God. And then we also saw that the people were grumbling after the Red Sea on their way to Mount Sinai for a lack of water, for a lack of food. That's another indication that even after all God had done through the plagues and at the Red Sea, their hearts were still not right. Furthermore, even at Mount Sinai, remember, the people ask that God not speak to them directly. They're fearful. They want Moses to serve as their mediator in some sense. Let me read to you verses 18 to 20 of Exodus chapter 20. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us lest we die. Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin. So that's where we are up until Exodus 32. We have this statement, great statements, about the mediator. It's not completely clear they need a mediator, though we have these hints along the way that they might. But in chapter 32, the people commit a terrible sin. And like you after that imaginary car accident, now they see they have a great need for mediation. It's obvious. It's personal because they realize they deserve to be destroyed. It is serious. So this morning, what I want to do is to remind you of the story of Exodus 32 to 34, and then look at this topic under two headings. First, the need for a mediator, and then secondly, the role of a mediator. And there we'll compare Moses and Jesus. And then we'll conclude with the picture of ourselves as priests and our own need for a mediator. So first of all, let me remind you of the story of what happens in Exodus 32 to 34. Remember, Moses is up on the mountain, and the people are becoming uneasy because he's been there a long time. And they go to Aaron and say, make for us gods who will go before us, for as for this Moses who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. And Aaron, lacking courage, does not tell the people, this is horrible, we cannot possibly do this, God has just commanded us not to, but instead tells them to bring their gold jewelry, and he fashions an idol, a bull, out of this gold jewelry. He tries to modify what they're saying to push them towards worshiping the true God via this idol. He says, tomorrow we're going to have a feast for Yahweh. But even that, God has told them, is wrong and despicable. They are not to worship him in any way they choose. So this is an explicit, horrible breaking of the Ten Commandments. Just weeks after they've said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do, they break the commandments. Well, God tells Moses what is happening, and he tells Moses to leave him alone and let him destroy the people, and God will make a new people out of the descendants of Moses. But Moses pleads for the people. He acknowledges the depth of their sin, but he asks God not to destroy the people on the basis of God's glory, God's reputation with the surrounding nations, and on the basis of his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the past. And so God does not destroy the people. Moses comes down carrying this picture of God's agreement with his people, his covenant, the words of the Ten Commandments written on tablets of stone. And when he comes down and he sees the people, he throws down the tablets and breaks them, signifying that the people have broken decisively their agreement with God. He then calls the Levites, his own tribe, together. Or rather, he calls anyone who's on the Lord's side to him, and his own tribe, the Levites, come. And then God commands through Moses that they go through the camp and kill those who are most set on idolatry. And one out of every 200 adult males is killed. And then a plague follows that. Well, Moses knows that though judgment is deferred, there is still a need for mediation, still a need for atonement. And so he goes back up on the mountain. And as he writes in Deuteronomy 9:18, describing this time, he says, "Then I lay prostrate before the Lord as before, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all the sin that you had committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger." And so Moses is pleading with God, and God tells him, "I cannot go with this people. This is a stiff-necked people. If I go with them, even for a moment, I'm going to kill them." So Moses pleads for forgiveness and says, "If God won't forgive the people, please destroy him also." Well, God tells Moses that he has found favor with God. He has found grace with him. And so Moses pleads on the basis of that favor that he's found with God to please go with them, to go in the midst of the people as he had planned previously. And God eventually agrees to this. And then Moses asks God, "Show me your glory." And we saw that this is a request not just for a personal display of God's glory, but a request that God might show for all the people who he is. And God says no one can see his face and live, but he will show Moses part of his glory. And he will proclaim his name before Moses. That is, he will describe what he is like. And so God instructs Moses to make two more stone tablets like the first ones. And then Exodus 34, verse 1, God says, "I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke." Now, this is a very important point here. God tells Moses he's going to restore his covenant, the same covenant as before. He's going to restore with his people. So Moses goes up on the mountain. God passes before him. He proclaims that he is gracious and merciful and slow to anger, but by no means will he clear the guilty. And then verse 9 of Exodus 34. Moses said, "If now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and sin, and take us for your inheritance." And God agrees. In verse 10, he says, "Behold, I am making a covenant." He's renewing the same covenant that he made before. And so, in the next several verses, God repeats selected commands that he has given before from Exodus 20 to 23. These aren't new commands, and these are not more important commands than the other commands. Rather, they are a summary representing the entirety of the commands that God had given before. Remember, God told Moses he's going to write the same words on those new tablets of stone. And along the way, God reiterates his promise that he's going to bring this people into the promised land and drive out the inhabitants of that land before them. So, despite the enormity of the people's sin, God has restored his covenant with his people. And the section then concludes with the verses we read during the service. That Moses comes down from speaking with God, and his face has rays of light shining out from it. And Aaron and the people are afraid. Indeed, I think they see their own guilt as they see the glory of God manifest in the face of Moses. They seem to fear judgment, condemnation, when they contrast themselves, guilty as they are, with this shining, glorious face of Moses. Well, Moses, face uncovered, face still beaming, tells the people all the words that God has spoken. And this is all that God spoke from chapter 24 to this point. Moses has clearly been with God. He's been affected by the glory of God in a way that is obvious to his listeners. And once the words are spoken, Moses covers his face. Don't think of this as something completely covering his face, but like a veil that people in the Middle East would wear. His eyes are there so he can see where he's going. But he's covered the rest of his face until the next time he's with God, when he then will remove that veil and look at God. And apparently, Moses' face is beaming the rest of his life. We're never told here that that glory ever changes. And when you look at the ESV of 2 Corinthians 13, where some people think that it's saying that that glory is fading, as the ESV rightly translates it, there's no indication even there that the glory on Moses' face ever went away. Well, that's the story. What does this tell us about the need for a mediator? Why do people need a mediator? There are three reasons highlighted in these chapters. First of all, the depth of the people's sin. Even in Egypt, the people blamed Moses when Pharaoh made their work harder. And then they were inconsistent, as we noted, in following Moses once they had left Egypt. But you might think, with a little more effort, with a few more New Year's resolutions, with a clearer revelation of God as they had had at Mount Sinai, that they could be God's people, that they could live up to their promise to do whatever God told them. But by the time we get to Exodus 33, it's real obvious that that is not the case. There is no way that these people, by their own self-effort, are going to live up to the commandments that God has given them. If they cannot obey the Ten Commandments while they're at the very mountain where God has spoken to them, they're surely not going to be able to live up those commandments once they enter the promised land and face the temptations of the people who live in that land. No. Sin is deeply rooted in these people. Second reason for a need for a mediator is the nature of the people's sin. What happens when the Israelites sin? What happens when we sin? What's going on? These are the people God has called to himself to be, he says, Israel is his firstborn son. They are his precious possession. They are set apart for his pleasure, for his delight. And just so with us. When we break his laws, what are we doing? We're violating the very purpose of our creation as mankind and our creation as the people of God. We deserve God's judgment and punishment. We turn our backs on God. But even more fundamentally, think about what Paul says in Romans 2:23. He says, you dishonor God when you break his law. You dishonor God when you break his law. That Greek word translated dishonor means to deprive someone of honor and respect. So take this to heart. We're created to glorify God. And through our transgressions, through our disobedience, we de-glorify God. We dishonor him. We take honor that should be his away from him. We make the one who is worthy of all praise appear as if he is not praiseworthy at all. That's the nature of the Israelite sin. And that's the nature of our sin. Third reason that there is a need for a mediator is shown in these chapters. God's revelation of his character. As he spoke to Moses when he passed by, he is merciful and gracious and slow to anger, but by no means will he clear the guilty. And how can he be both? We asked this 2 weeks ago. There's got to be some way that God's going to reconcile those two aspects of his character. To be merciful and gracious and to be just, to make sure that the guilty are punished. And that's what a mediator does, is to make sure that both of those things happen. God is just and he is merciful. So, the Israelites are ruined sinners. Their actions deserve God's wrath. Apart from the acts of a mediator, God will wipe them out. But because he is merciful and gracious, God provides such a mediator. And the people of Israel are in parallel with us. All those statements are true. That we are ruined sinners. We deserve his punishment. We deserve his destruction of us, his sentencing us to hell. We need a mediator. And God, because he is merciful and gracious, provides that mediator. Well, let's now look at the role of a mediator. That is the role of a priest. In our definition of the priests from chapters 28 and 29, I mentioned there were three roles of the priest. He intercedes, he displays and he proclaims God's character, and then he provides a sacrifice or announces the provision of a sacrifice. So let's go through those three roles and see how Moses fulfills them for the people of Israel, and compare him at each step with Jesus and how Jesus fulfills those roles yet more fully for us. So first role, intercession. He intercedes with God on behalf of the people. There are five parallels between Moses and Jesus under intercession. Some of them are exact parallels, and sometimes there's a distinction. A way that Jesus intercedes yet more effectively, more fully than Moses. So first parallel. Moses intercedes with God, and God's wrathful judgment is averted. And it's exactly the same with Jesus. Jesus intercedes with God, and God's wrathful judgment is averted. Now, there's a distinction in the type of judgment. The judgment that would have fallen on the Israelites is a temporal judgment. The judgment that would fall on us, that Jesus averts, is an eternal, permanent judgment in hell. Second parallel. Moses intercedes on the basis of God's glory. And Jesus, too, intercedes on the basis of God's glory. Yet there is a distinction. Moses warns God what the destruction of these people in the desert will do to his reputation. God will lose glory amongst the surrounding tribes. Jesus accepts that God's destruction of he himself will glorify God's name. You see? Jesus takes that penalty, that wrath on himself for the glory of God. As he says in John 12, 27 and 28, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Glorify your name through my crucifixion." Third parallel. Moses intercedes on the basis of God's past promises to Abraham. Jesus is the fulfillment of God's past promises to Abraham. And he intercedes on the basis of that fulfillment. Fourth parallel. Moses goes back up to the mountain, hoping perhaps to make atonement for the sin of the golden calf, as he says in Exodus 2, verse 30. There's this perhaps, he doesn't know if he's going to be able to do that or not. But Jesus goes to the cross knowing that he makes atonement for all the sin of all of those who will ever trust in him, all those who are united to him. Fifth and last, Moses made repeated intercession for this sin and for the next 40 plus years he makes additional intercession for this sin. Jesus continuously, unceasingly makes intercession for our sin. As we read from Hebrews 7, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Well, that's the first role of the priest as intercessor. Second role of the priest, to display and proclaim God's character. Here there are two parallels between Moses and Jesus. First, by God's grace, Moses has an intimate relationship with God the Father. And he therefore shows, displays what God is like. What's the parallel with Jesus? By his own character, Jesus has an intimate relationship with God the Father and shows what he's like. You see the difference? In God's gracious act, he accepts Moses. And yet Moses was a murderer. There was no necessity of a display of grace for Jesus because he was always perfect. He had no sin to separate him from God, as Moses did. God says to Moses in Exodus 33:12, "I know you by name, and you have also found favor or grace in my sight." So God says, "You are mine, Moses. I know you inside out, and I grant you this grace, this favor, so that we can be in relationship." But what does God say to Jesus? At his baptism, he says, "You are my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. You are intimately related to me, and I am pleased with who you are and what you do." So there's an important distinction there. When God is pleased with Moses, indeed, when he's pleased with us, he is pleased with what he has accomplished in us. When God is pleased with Jesus, he is pleased with who he is in his inner self. God's pleasure in us, God's pleasure in Moses, is ultimately his pleasure in his own Son. God looks at us if we are united with Christ by faith, and he sees Jesus himself. He sees his character, his righteousness, all credited to our account. And this delights him. So Moses has this intimate relationship with God, but it's one which is based on the one who is to come. And we can have that same intimate relationship with God so that God looks at us with great joy, but what he sees is Jesus in us. Second parallel under displaying character. Moses' face shines with the glory of God. People looked at the face of Moses and saw something of what God is like. What's the parallel with Jesus? People looked at Jesus and they saw exactly what God is like. Remember? The interchange between Philip and Jesus at the Last Supper was recorded in John 14. Philip says, "Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us." Remember Jesus' response? "Have I been with you so long, Philip, and you still do not know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me?" So Jesus is the ultimate display of God's character. Moses shows God's glory, and Jesus shows it so much more. Well, this leads us to the final role of the priest regarding sacrifice. Providing a sacrifice or announcing the provision of a sacrifice. Think more about the Israelites' reaction to Moses' beaming face. Earlier, God had said in Exodus 33:20, "You cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live." Well, why were the Israelites fearful? Could it be that they see in Moses' face not enough of God's glory to kill them, but enough of God's glory to know that they are condemned, to know that they deserve death? Could it be that they see this and yet they don't have complete confidence in Moses' mediation, in Moses' ability to make atonement for them? Could it be that they rightly see the need for a death to take place in order to pay the penalty for their sin of the golden calf? And they do not yet understand how God is going to provide the lamb to pay that penalty, to undergo that death. For consider this final parallel and distinction between Moses and Jesus. Moses would rather die than to have the people destroyed. Exodus 32:32, Moses says to God, "But now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of the book that you have written." So Moses has a great concern for the people. He has a concern for the glory of God. He has a concern for God's promises. And so he says, I'd rather die than to have your people destroyed, have your glory dragged through the dirt because of that, have your promises look like they have all been lost. I don't want to live if that's the case. And Moses is exemplary for us in this regard, for his passion for God's glory, his heart for the people. But even if Moses were to die, that would do no good. If Moses dies, he dies for his own sin. He can't take on anyone else's sin. He can't take on the sin of the people. But what about Jesus? Jesus did die to save his people. And not only his natural people, the Jews, but what Paul calls all the seed of Abraham. Hebrews chapter 10. Every priest stands daily at a service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. That's our Savior. That's our mediator. That is Jesus. Well then, in conclusion, 3 points. First, are you like Moses at the end of chapter 34? Does your face shine, beam out, because you've been in God's presence? Are you changed because of your interaction daily with God? As we read from 2 Corinthians 3, we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image with ever-increasing glory, as one translation puts it. When others see this, some will fear, like the Israelites. Some will feel condemned. Some will hate in response. Some will reject. But are you eager to enter God's presence, to see His glory and to be changed by it? Are you, as our fighter verse for today says, seeking one thing, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, and thus to take on that beauty, and thereby to be an effective and faithful priest to the unbelievers around you, displaying God's character in word and in deed, proclaiming His love and mercy and grace? Are you like Moses? Are you shining forth with God's image? He offers us that. He offers us that. He requires that of us. Second, do you acknowledge your need for a mediator? Do you acknowledge that deep down inside, at the very core of your being, you are a rebel against God? Or do you belittle your sins, acting as if they're really not all that important and they're not nearly as bad as the person sitting next to you? Do you agree with Paul that whenever you break God's law, you dishonor Him, you de-glorify Him? Do you acknowledge that there's nothing you can do personally to make up for that dishonor? No matter how many good works you have done, no matter how frequently you enter this building, no matter how many great deeds you do, do you acknowledge that, like the Israelites, you deserve to be wiped out? You deserve to be consigned to hell? Do you acknowledge that you need a mediator? Third, Third point. Friends, we have such a mediator. We have such a mediator. Jesus, the Son of God. Jesus, who came to save his people from their sins. Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. Jesus, who always lives to make intercession for his people. Jesus, the wonderful, merciful Savior, the precious Redeemer and friend. Jesus, the spotless Lamb of God. Only Jesus can be that mediator. So will you cry out, "Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus." Through his death on the cross, Jesus pays the penalty for all the sins of all who trust in him. So believe in him. Trust in him. We need not fear God's righteous wrath. We can see his glory. We can come into his presence. We can boldly approach his throne because of the nature of the mediator. We can trust. We can have great joy in his presence. So delight in that one great mediator. Delight in our only hope, Jesus, the Son of God. Only Jesus.